frightened people are valuable.
Is it because if we are afraid of being tortured, we won't speak out? That you know, it's funny, in the chat room on the horn, people are warning me all the time, Mark, you know, be careful, you'll be sent to Guantanamo Bay. And maybe I'm just stupid and I think that as an I still should be free to speak out and criticize these things without consequence. But is that what it is, to keep people like me and not speaking out, be afraid that we'll be tortured or something?
Hasn't it ever crossed your mind that you could disappear?
It has, but that's why I jokingly tell people at the horn, you know, hey, if Guantanamo Bay, please lead a protest. If I don't appear on the air one day, look, come find me. Come find me.
I know it seems outrageous, and there's no lie that is more easy to sell than an outrageous because of the fact that people say, that's outrageous. That couldn't happen here. That couldn't happen here, Mark. It can happen here.
Well, we know already that American citizen Jose Padilla was, you know, taken at Chicago Airport and held in jail for years without trial. And in fact, just recently, I talked about the case of Mr. I think it's Al, what's his name? The German citizen who was taken. Khalid Al-Masri, who was taken to Afghanistan and tortured, you know, he'd done absolutely nothing wrong. But he was kept, you know, tiny, filthy cell and shackled and drugged and beaten and interrogated. And the worst part is when he sues and says, sorry, yeah, that's just the way America is. We randomly pick up people and torture them. Oops. No one is ever held accountable for that. It makes it clear that we are becoming the Soviet Union, and it is very scary.
Stalin's Russia right now.
It's very scary, and you know I don't know how Americans it's one of the reasons why I have Republicans on my shows, because I can't understand how they can deal with it. I mean, how do they put that in their heads? I'm going to have another one on soon, just so I can ask him that question.
Yeah.
How can you possibly justify not even hearing the case? I mean, the Supreme Court said, if the government says it's a state secret, then all right, so we tortured a few people and killed a few people and beaten a few people, and oh, well, that's what governments do.
Mark, what about the prison right in New York City that right now is housing I don't know how many Middle Eastern people who are probably innocent of any wrongdoing, who have not been allowed an attorney, who have been, yes, indeed, tortured, because some of them have gotten out and spoken about it. How about that?
I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you what it is. If you are not an American citizen, I mean, and we talked about Jose Padilla precisely because he is an American citizen.
Sure,
but
is.
Largely it's the exception. Generally, most of these vicious things that our government does are done to non-citizens. And I think that's one reason why the American people kind of let it happen and don't talk about it very much, because they think, oh, well, you know, I'm a citizen. What's that?
You know, come on, people. Wake up.
I'll tell you, the German government is not taking this lightly. They have indicted 13 people in the CIA. They will not be allowed to leave the United States or go to Europe, because they will be captured. And if they, and I hope they are, and I hope they're tried, and I hope they're sent, you know, after a fair trial, sent to a German prison for life. And wouldn't
Donald
that be
Rumsfeld
a terrific?
Is one of them.
Yeah. Well,
he cannot go to Germany.
That's right.
And there's quite a few.
And isn't it sad that the same country that we taught Nuremberg laws to is now having to teach the same lesson to us? I mean, isn't that? I mean, irony doesn't quite cut it. It's disgusting. It's shameful.
It's beyond irony, and I'll tell
it's
you something.
It's shameful.
This country has gone so far to the right. We are so totally morally bankrupt as a country right now. We are despised all over the world. I watched a documentary yesterday about Iraq that just broke my heart. And all this documentary showed was a day in the life of an Iraqi family.
Yeah.
What those people are living is unbelievable.
I know. I showed on my television show, it's still in my video archive, in a that you really should take a look at. It's Are We Creating More Terrorists Than We Kill was the name of the show, where I showed a YouTube from an Iraqi family. But
well,
one distinction
that,
I want to make with you, Jennifer.
Terrorist for a minute there.
I want to make one distinguishing thing, though, Jennifer. When you say that we are morally... one thing I want to say, when you say we are morally bankrupt as a country, I have to say this. I think that there should always be a distinction made between the government of the United States and the American people, because I think we are coming out of this morass. I think that the American people are waking up. It's been slow, admittedly. It's been too slow, admittedly. I agree with all of that. But I do think there's a reason why George Bush's approval ratings in the toilet. There's a reason why we elected a Democratic Congress. There's a reason why hopefully we're going to elect a Democratic president in 2008, because the American people don't want to be known as the country that approves of torture. So I just want to make the distinction. I don't want to – I think the bottom of my heart, I'm an optimist and I'm a patriotic American, and I consider Bush a cancer on this nation. But I think that the nation itself is still healthy enough to reject this, and maybe I'm just hopeful.
No, I think you're right. I think if you asked any individual in this country if they approve of it, they would say no, with few exceptions.
Right.
There would
one of the things I want to talk about.
People say, hell yes, I would do that.
And I want to thank you for your call, Jennifer, and I want to encourage you to call in again sometime. You were a terrific caller. In the last few minutes, though, I want to go over how the American people and the representatives responded to these early tortures by the Bush administration, and how the Bush administration used tortured logic to get around the law. All right? So here it is. Thanks for your call, though, Jennifer, and I hope you'll call again
sometime. Thank you, Mark.
So here it is. We've approved John Yoo's memo that says you can do all these awful things. And we did them, you know, hundreds of times on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. We now know that he told the interrogators virtually anything, exaggerated, false, it didn't matter. We now know, at least some of us know, that actually, as Dave put it, you know, patient, repeated questioning is better than harsh physical pressure. But what happened is a new guy came into the Office of Legal Counsel, Jack Goldsmith, who's now written a book on this, that describes the details of I mean, he's really the one probably who we should thank for these leaks. I don't know that I agree with Jennifer that they were planted by the administration. I don't know. But I do know that Jack Goldsmith got in a lot of hot water because he rejected the surveillance program. He rejected the torture memo. He rejected all of that, just like James Comey did. And the Justice Department, 6 months later, and this is, I think, again, reflecting the values of the American people who are watching this, said in a new legal opinion that got rid of John Hughes, the first sentence, quote, torture is abhorrent both to American law and values and to international norms. Footnote. And in the footnote, it said, that doesn't mean that anything the CIA has done has been illegal. In fact, everything they did in the past was perfectly legal. Talk about bearing the lead. Torture is abhorrent both to American law and values and to international norms. First sentence. Footnote. That doesn't mean we've ever done anything wrong. And indeed, the Justice Department then set out to fire those who were dissenting. One of the first was a guy by the name of Daniel Levin. Like my name, only without E on the end, L-E-V-I-N. Nice to know that my namesake also backed the dissents, also rejected torture, and found himself a new job. No, instead they hired a guy named Bradbury. And Bradbury was put on a notice, really. He was a good old Federal Society guy. He was someone who seemed to want to do everything the Bush administration wanted to do, but they put him on probation. And kept him on probation, did not tell him whether or not he would get the job until they made sure that he did everything the White House wanted him to do. It's a great way to take a watchdog agency like the Office of Legal Counsel and make sure they follow everything. Comey objected, And Bradbury did things like block career lawyers. Remember, this is supposed to be not a political position, but career lawyers, people like an Ivy League law professor that he made sure would not get in the way. He approved the combined techniques. You can freeze someone and deny them food and water while slapping them and drowning them. Comey, to his credit, said, this is from the New York Times, at one testy 2004 White House meeting, Comey said no lawyer would endorse John Yoo's justification for the surveillance program. Addington disagreed. Addington, of course, is Cheney's lawyer, the guy who has been behind all of these surveillance and torture memos. And Comey shot back, no good lawyer. So he was someone who was willing to stand up. But he left. This is, of course, the same question that I've always been asked with Colin Powell. You know, what do you do when you're in a corrupt administration and you see evil things happening? Do you try, as Powell did, to stay in there, not criticize it publicly, and work it from the inside, which turned out to be ineffective? Or do you do what Comey did, which is leave and criticize the administration, the more respectable thing, but he left. He wasn't there. And Bradbury was in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel. And so even when the United States Congress, under the influence of John McCain, in an overwhelming vote, 90 senators voted that we do uphold the Geneva Conventions, a vote that isn't even necessary because the Geneva Conventions are already American law. Even though the Convention Against Torture prohibits cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, here comes another secret memo by Bradbury. Nothing we've done is cruel, inhumane, or degrading. It's not cruel to slap someone in the head senseless. It's not inhumane to deny someone food and sleep. It's not degrading to put someone naked in a cell at freezing temperature until they're shivering. That's not degrading. It's perfectly normal stuff. Waterboarding. Simulated drowning. Not a problem. It was Bradbury who took the president's signing statement after that congressional law and made sure that it had no basis, that it had no meaning whatsoever. George Bush says we don't torture, but he defines none of the practices he's ever done as torture. And that, my friends, is not just torture. It's tortured logic. That's it for the Inside Scoop today. Tune in tomorrow. For now, there's a Bob Kincaid's prayer meeting coming up. This is Mark Levine signing off.
The Quality News Network. President Bush wants to give telecommunications companies immunity in the new eavesdropping law. The legislation would allow the National Security Agency to listen in to phone conversations without warrants. The multinational force in Iraq will be down to 7,000 troops, excluding American forces. That is down from the once 50,000-member large coalition. U.S. forces in Iraq are at a peak surge high of 168,000 forces currently. In Pakistan, as many as 250 people have been killed in recent fighting near the Afghan border. The Pakistani army halted attacks today so that local residents could attend funerals. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas wants a future independent state to have pre-1967 borders. He is also calling for a complete Israeli withdrawal from the territories it captured four decades ago. The demands come in preparation for a U.S.-hosted Middle East peace conference next month.
Okay, Tokyo, South America, I'll make you proud. and Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hello, 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 hello. Welcome to Hump Day, Wednesday, October the 10th. This is America Back on Track. Doesn't mean that we're on track. It doesn't mean that we're back on track. It means that we're going to be back on track. And that's what this program is all about here on the Quality News Network. Good afternoon. I'm your correspondent, Tony Seaton. Today, we're going to have John Dean talking with us about broken government. He is the fellow of Watergate fame, a conservative, a very bright fellow, one of the few people who overcame the adversity of what Watergate was about and did something with his life. In our second half hour, Carlin Sloan is a consultant, business consultant. She's got a book called Smarter, Faster, Better. And we're going to talk about the fact that some people have to slow down to speed up in business, and that actually makes sense. Today's Seat Notes is on getting Cuba right. Our quote of the day from Samuel Adams, who said, "If ye love wealth greater than liberty, the tranquility of servitude greater than the animating contest for freedom, go home from us in peace. We seek not your counsel nor your arms. Crouch down and lick the hand that feeds you, and may posterity forget that ye were our countrymen." Got that? Some observations on the news. The killing of two Iraqi women by mercenaries, private contractors working for an Australian firm, is sharpening the focus on the death and destruction these so-called security forces wreak. In ostensibly protecting diplomats and other foreigners in this hellish situation, they tend to fire first and drive fast past whatever they kill. They seem to view every vehicle moving in their direction as a suicide bomber. Every individual standing by the side of the road is a terrorist planting an explosive device. But sometimes those folks are just plain folks, like the two women killed Monday by the Australians, like the 17 killed by Blackwater mercenaries on September 16th. The people doing the killing consider it regrettable, but collateral damage, said the spokesman of one mercenary outfit of the killings this week. We have every reason to believe that proper security protocols were followed. Oh, good. Don't we all feel a lot better about that now? The Democrats tried to push home the disgrace of President Bush's veto of the health care bill that would have covered millions of American children by presenting a child who had benefited from such coverage. 12-year-old Graham Frost was alive after a car crash because he had that federal health care coverage. But the right-wing nuts, and they're not right in terms of being right or wrong, they're right in terms of being far right. In typical fashion, they went after the boy and his family tooth and nail. Here's how it was described in a Times article. The critics accused Graham's father, Halsey, a self-employed woodworker, of choosing not to provide insurance for his family of six, even though he owned his own business. They pointed out that Graham attends an expensive private school, and they asserted that the family's home had undergone extensive remodeling and that its market value could exceed $400,000. Well, apparently, the complaints were all vituperation based on little or no fact. Here's how the article explained it. Graham attends the private school on scholarship. The business that the critics said Mr. Frost owned was actually dissolved 8 years ago in 1999. The family's home is in the modest Butchers Hill neighborhood of Baltimore, was bought for $55,000 in 1990 and is now worth probably about $260,000, according to public records. And the Frosts say their kitchen counters, which the Harpies said were granite, are actually concrete. There were more details, but the point is the scurrilousness of these frenzied fascists who are more interested in stomping whom they perceive as opposition, regardless of the truth. They're not limited to the neocons. Of course, some of the Dems do it. The liberals do it. But these folks in particular on the right seem hell-bent, and that's where they should be going, on showing the worst human face. He's one of the people you thought might have died and you didn't notice. He surfaces and then you wish you'd been right. I'm thinking of George Steinbrenner in this case, a man who defines the lack of class. He told Yankee manager Joe Torre that if the team didn't beat Cleveland on Sunday night, he'd fire him. The Yankees pulled off the win on Sunday, but lost on Monday. Torres is probably going to be gone soon. Now, I met the Yankee owner back in the '70s when I was a producer at ABC News. We were taping a feature piece on him, and I was in the skybox during the playoffs picking up some voiceover footage. Steinbrenner had accessorized him with a bunch of city notables, among them a city councilman or two and a priest. But to give you a sense of how important they were to him, when the priest accidentally walked in front of him, Steinbrenner virtually sneered at him. He had his problems, including getting into trouble writing a check he shouldn't have to the Nixon campaign way back when, and he deserved them all. There was an old joke that Oral Roberts was putting his messages out on 45 RPM records, but they didn't sell because the hole in the center of the record kept healing closed. Good one, huh? What's happening now at his university under the control of his son and daughter-in-law ain't going to heal anytime soon. It appears the younger Roberts has been spending considerable sums on home remodeling projects, jetting his daughter on a senior trip to the Bahamas, and new cars. Spicing up the story even more is that Wifey is not only spending lots of money on clothes and awarding scholarships to friends of her children, but she is also apparently spending lots of attention on underaged males. Pop, Oral, is still alive, age 89, living in California, told Larry King by phone last night that he was shocked by the charges against his son and daughter-in-law. Yes, indeed, the line between hucksterism and prison time can be thin when it comes to mass preaching. Finally, our first president is sounding smarter and smarter these days, recently quoted by, of all people, a Wall Street executive, George Washington. In his farewell address, warned against, quote, ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burdens we ourselves ought to bear. Indeed. Coming up in a couple of minutes and a couple of seconds, John Dean, author of Broken Government, and much more right here on America Back on Track. Stay tuned.
I know your secret. Nobody told me, but I know. Every time your little girl wants you to read her a story and you tell her you're too busy, I know. When your boy needs help with homework and you tell him to ask his mother, I know. Your wife asks you whether the warranty is still good on the broken dishwasher and you tell her you're too tired to look for it, I know. You're very good at keeping the secret, but it does take a lot of effort to keep the charade going. It could be very scary and embarrassing if anyone found out. But I know your secret. You can't read. Neither can 93 million American adults. You're in big company. Instead of running scared, become a hero in your own family. Find a local literacy program at your library. It's free. The day you whisper in your wife's ear, honey, I can read, just watch how big her smile is.
This message on literacy has been brought to you as a public service by the Quality News Network. For more information, please contact your local library.
Huell Hauser talks to customers of First National, South Valley, and San Benito Banks, local members of the network of preferred community banks.
We're here to talk with people about their business banking.
What are you looking for in your business bank?
Somebody that can offer me services such as car loans, equipment loans, leases, a line of credit.
And do you think because they're local, they understand your needs better than a bigger bank would?
Yes, I think they're really aware of the community and are here to help the small business people.
So it's a local bank with big bank services?
Absolutely. They're here on a regular basis to make sure if there's any other services they can provide, they're here to talk about it.
Now, it's a community bank, but it's part of a network of banks.
We searched out a bank that would have the flexibility and the understanding of our needs and a willingness to spend the time doing that.
Above and Beyond Banking from the network of preferred community banks. Available locally at First National Bank of Central California, South Valley National Bank, and San Benito Bank.
We're back. America Back on Track. And most pleased to have with us by telephone John Dean. John, welcome to America Back on Track.
Pleasure.
You don't remember me, I'm sure, but I covered the Senate Watergate hearings way back in 73. I did meet, in fact, Charles Schaffer and Bob McCandless, and it was a fascinating time. I actually have the front page of your statement that you delivered, what was it, a couple hundred pages, framed. on a wall in my house.
Is that right?
It was a wonderful time. I was, I think, 22 or 23 at the time, and
were you at one of the press tables?
Yes, yes, I was with.
You had a front row seat.
I certainly did. I remember that so vividly. There were 2 days of testimony, and I remember going back to the office at ABC, and Howard K. Smith had watched the hearings online, and he was saying, scoffing, he said, oh, Dean's testimony, you could drive a truck through it. I think he actually said that in one of his commentaries. And, of course, those of us who were covering the hearing knew quite different. An amazing time.
It was. It was actually a week.
You were on, that, you were on for, you, you read your statement for 2 days. And
I,
then,
I read the statement for 8 hours, and
yeah.
then I took cross-examination for 4 more days.
What did you think about that, John? What was? Do you look back on that much at all?
Not really. The bulk of that testimony went to the Smithsonian along with my glasses. So you've got a collector's item there.
I do
you
indeed.
You got one of the pages. I hadn't planned to read that statement. I didn't write it to read it. I just wrote it, and I thought I would just give a summary of it, and then dash. And Irvin insisted I read the whole thing, and I said, I thought, God, this is going to take a while. So I read it in my best monotone to try not to give it any theatrics at all, which it took 8 hours to do.
John, I covered that, and I've been covering the news for over 40 years, and I find you to have been so different from so many of the people involved in that Nixon White House. I guess you sort of explained some of that in Blind Ambition.
I think I probably did. I was never I didn't drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak.
Yes.
And was known for my dissenting views on a lot of things, and not always to the pleasure of my colleagues. I was just reading something that was sent me by as a result of some of the stuff on Thompson, on Fred Thompson, and some of the Nixon tapes about how I was trying to actually leave the White House long before Watergate even became a glimmer in anybody's eyes, and they wouldn't let me go. They said, "You owe it to us to stay until the end of the administration." So I think they probably had second thoughts. They probably wished they let me go.
Indeed. When you look back on those days, or, you know, not so much the looking back, but when I think about, I covered Haldeman, of course, and Ehrlichman, and I was there when Butterfield made his announcement. Those people were doing considerable damage to our country, but they don't hold a candle to what's going on today.
I never, ever in my wildest imagination dreamed I'd be writing the books I'm writing today. I thought we had written a book on what not to do, and the fact that later Republican presidents would make that the opening chapter of what they wanted to do, it's mind-boggling. It is stupefying. You look at Nixon's so-called Watergate abuses, and nobody died, nobody was tortured, millions of Americans weren't subject to electronic surveillance without a warrant when they made a foreign call. I mean, we're just playing in such a different league today. It's staggering. It just numbs my mind. That's why, you know, I wrote this last book is a third in a trilogy. I'd really like to write myself out of this genre. It isn't something I find terribly pleasant to write about, but since a lot of people in the mainstream are ignoring it, I just am going to keep going because it troubles me.
It is very troubling. And what is it? Is it an evolution or de-evolution of our culture that we pay so little attention to what the values that you and I would share?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think explains part of it, because I've asked a lot of people who work back and cover Washington Today why they're not banging away at this stuff, and I've been given a couple answers. First of all, they tell me that there's been a generational change, which obviously doesn't surprise you or I. There are several generations have come in there, but the new generation they really often can't distinguish much between, say, Watergate and Teapot Dome. They think they might have been closely related. But there are old hands there still, no question. People that have been there for a long time. Bob Woodward, an old friend of mine. I not recently was an interlocutor at a thing he did out here in California, and I was able to welcome him back from his trip in stenography on the Bush first two Bush books to actually doing some journalism on his third book. We must hope he does. He stays in journalism, at least as he's working on this new book. But anyway, I've been asking people like Woodward. Woodward sort of shrugs and doesn't really want to talk about it. Doesn't really. I think it's a matter of access. And a number of the old timers have told me they've never seen an administration that has manipulated the press as cleverly as Bush and Cheney have, where they punish them when they don't write stories they like. At least they got away with this for the first 6 years. They don't let them get very far off the reservation and keep them right at the trough. And if they try to get too imaginative in their writing and critical in any way, they end up getting no access at all, and that, of course, is the name of the game. The other thing I was wondering about was corporate consolidation. Had that affected them? I found nobody who told me that they had, had an editor or a producer say, hey, you can't go there, or you can't do that story. What the problem is with the bottom line and fewer people in the newsroom, what you find is men and women who are covering Washington have much more to do and less time to do it. They don't have time to investigative journalism is the exception and no longer the rule.
And it should be redundant for that matter. I mean, covering Watergate was a very significant different approach to what's going on today. And I think that access issue is terribly important. I was speaking to a former aide of Nancy Pelosi about it and how they tell the reporters who have the White House credentials, I don't think we're going to have you back. And their control of the access, it's such a big ego trip to be a White House correspondent that they do toe the line when instead they should all rise up together and say, no, we will determine who will cover the White House, and we want someone who is a White House spokesman who will tell us the truth, or we're going to flame them.
Well, that's the way it used to be. There used to be a White House White House press pool or group that decided who would have access, and it was only to getting the clearance through the Secret Service. But that has slowly evolved away to today, where now the White House says who can come in and who cannot for coverage. I think the media ought to be deciding who's there and who's not there. It's grown grossly out of shape. I mean, there are too many people for too few people to be covering. When you have 1,200 people assigned to the White House, it's absurd. They can't all get in the briefing room for openers. They have to rotate. Some people like Maureen Dowd can't even get credentials to go in. So it's just bizarre stuff. But Bush and Cheney have been very effective at it. They've picked up really where Reagan left off. It was more open during the Clinton years, but I'm told they just shut it down, and it's been very good. So that's one of the reasons I still have a lot of friends in Washington, both elected and some serving in high places in this administration. I don't like unidentified sources like Woodward. So when I write something, I just take my cues from people who I'm talking to, and they say, "Hey, John, you might be interested in looking at what Cheney is doing here, here, and here," and I do, and then that's where I go, and that's how I have been flushing this stuff up that nobody else is paying any attention to.
So do you now call yourself a journalist, John?
Not really. More just a former insider who knows where to look, where the soft spots are. It's more of a commentator than a journalist. I do some of interviewing. For example, a section I wrote on the court, I did use some people I didn't name in there because they have literally their law practice is before the Supreme Court, and they don't have very nice things to say about where that court's going now. The fundamentalists who now sit on the court frighten them as much as they do me. But I don't want to name these people because they have to go up there and argue for clients, and these guys are not forgiving up there. So
there is a real lack of a sense of fairness and justice that there used to be. It was compromised to a degree during previous administrations, people dealing with Ed Meese, for example, or some of the people in the Clinton administration. Lee Atwater's campaign for Bush 1 was getting scurrilous. But you sit down today and make a list of the things you find so objectionable, most objectionable, about the Bush administration, and it's despairing how long the list gets before the major issues before you put the pen down.
I know. In this book that I've got out now, Broken Government, what I did is rather than make a laundry list of everything that they've screwed up, which would be that would take much more space than I was willing to ask any reader to tolerate, I looked at the rather fundamental things they're doing to our system, where they're actually messing and gaming democracy. That's what I find troubling. So I went to the set of the core problems with each branch. When you look at the way Republicans run it, the way they run the Congress when they were in control, the way they're running the executive branch, and what they've done, literally starting with my presidency, Nixon, and no one realizes it, to the non-political branch, the federal courts. And it's not a pretty picture, and I happen to be enough of an optimist to believe that if people have that information, they'll do the right thing with it. At least about 75% of the American people will. About 25%, you couldn't change their view, and they would follow an authoritarian leader off the cliff wherever he led them.
Yeah, that's exactly the issue. But I think what those 75% need is a catalyst, someone to be the leader that they can get behind, who would draw together all these issues of health care, the environment, the Constitution, education, energy, all those things. But there doesn't seem to be anyone like that. None of the candidates in either party who are running for the White House has the substance to do that kind of leading.
Nobody has caught fire yet, that is for certain. But I think there's, and somebody who's traveling around the country a lot with this book and talking to an awful lot of people, I've had wonderful crowds show up at my events, and I get to talk to them both informally and formally. It's so early in the political season. I, in fact, had some debate with my publisher about doing a political book this early, and sort of decided because of the where I'm going, it's going to take time, and I'm as anxious to get this in front of the candidates and make them think about the issues I'm raising as I am the public. If I had anybody in mind, it was the Democrats who are running for president and the Democrats who are running for the House and Senate, that they're the ones who are going to have to grapple with the broken government, and if they don't address it, we're all in a whole heap of trouble. I've got three little grandchildren. I want to have inherit a very different country than the way this one's going right now.
Especially with the amount of debt that they're going to have to pay off. There's an excellent Tom Friedman piece today. He seems to have found his voice in the last week, where he talks about the college students and how they need. He's been going to various colleges. I don't know whether looking for a child, you know, one of his children or something. But he said these people are bright, but they're not paying attention, and they better, because they're going to be saddled with the bills that we're racking up for them.
Amen. Amen. In fact, Wall Street Journal had an interesting piece about 10 days ago, where they, at front page of the paper, they reported that the droves, the stampede of conservative businessmen who are leaving Republican ranks because of the incompetence of the party, because they don't think the social issues that the base of the party keeps insisting on, that we talk about gay marriages and things like that, it should be the sole issues we look at in this country. So they're leaving. They're taking their money with them. They're not signing up as Democrats. They're doing what I did. If they become non-affiliated. I still, in many regards, consider myself a Goldwater conservative on a lot of issues. I know that places me well left of center today.
Well, you know, actually, John, I'd say it's not about left of center. It's not about left or right, that we have to find someone above the fray. Because I used to be a liberal Democrat. I'm neither now. Because neither the left nor the right represents me, certainly neither the Democrats nor the Republicans. I mean, I look at what Congress is doing. I saw the headline in the Times, I think on Monday, where the Democrats are talking about giving Bush more access to eavesdropping and taking FISA entirely out of the play. What kind of insanity is that?
It is insanity. They've got to find their backbone. And you know who's going to force them to do it? Are the persons like yourself and myself who have moved from, you know, one side or the other to the middle, and are demanding some people stand up and be counted, and the only ones who are going to do it are the Democrats, and that we're that 40% in the middle now really control these elections.
Well, I hope so. I used to wear another hat. I was a political consultant. I did Nancy Pelosi's television in 96, and I both liked her and respected her, but I look at what's going on today. The FISA bill, for one thing, they're talking now about passing a measure that would criticize Turkey for the Armenian genocide in 1915. That's a century ago. What are we doing about Iraq? What are we?
Well, you know, Pelosi's done some good work, though. I've got to say that for my friends up on the Hill, they think that she's brought fresh air into the building. I mean, she's opened the windows. She's trying to bring civility back. She's dealing, however, with the very clever tactic that the Republicans used to first win the Congress after the Democrats had probably controlled it too long for 40 years. But they're back to their tricks of obstructionism, and it's very effective, where they, you know, the House passes stuff and it just goes into the ethers in the Senate with the threat of a filibuster. And American people don't get it. They say, well, hell, the Democrats aren't any better than the Republicans are running this place.
So what you're suggesting, I think, is that we need to change anchors and have Britney Spears, Paris Hilton, and Lindsay Lohan delivering the news, and then these issues will get through.
That might be the answer, spooky as it is. Well, we look at, you know, one of the shows where I get the strongest reaction, to my books is when I go out and do Jon Stewart's show.
Yes.
Which is a faux news program, but there's still a seed of information in everything he does. I also do Countdown a great deal. I like it because Keith is so damn bright as an anchor. But his producers put a lot of Britney on there. I'm sure he's not terribly happy with, because he once walked out when it was all Monica all the time and said, I just can't do another Monica story. I just can't look at myself and do another one.
Yes. Well, as I say, I was with ABC, and after Walter Cronkite left CBS in 1981, the thing has just gotten down to sizzle instead of steak. An evening newscast has about 20 minutes of news, 21 minutes of news, and I don't watch anymore. I don't watch the cable news, but I happened to catch a couple of minutes at the end of a Brian Williams newscast. It was a 2.5-minute feature on whether men or women were happier. But this is not atypical. They're going to feature stuff in nine minutes into the newscast, and it's perfectly non-elucidatory, even the stuff that they do cover.
Well, you know, I guess it's the old question of and this is, really comes up in leadership. In other words, do you follow the polls, or do you lead the people in the direction? The news people used to, you know, by keeping on important issues, they were indeed educating people. A lot of people tuned out now because of, you know, so damn diverse and so many places people can go to get their information. They are pandering to the lowest common denominator to get the most they can with the you know, it's not hard information anymore. But the other thing, the good thing is I'm optimistic because the internet does have obviously sites that are pure, solid, hard news. And you can go there and you can drink until you're exhausted, and a lot of people do. And a lot of those sites are very successful sites, high-traffic sites.
Well, you mentioned Jon Stewart, obviously cable. I was watching him before the 2004 election, and as a journalist comparing him to the mainstream media, he was delivering the news far better than the McNeil-Lehrer report was.
Oh, absolutely. He has an amazing, he does it with a smirk and a smile and a laugh here and there, but he puts an awful lot of information into his programs. Now, Colbert is another, he's just playing a persona, and you're not getting a lot of information there. It's just a big shtick sort of thing that he does, and he has fun with it. People enjoy it. It's certainly not a great source of information, though, whereas you actually can get information out of the Jon Stewart segment.
He provides context for it. He looks aghast at appropriate points, and he portrays people as liars. Let's talk about, for a moment, conservatives without conscience. How do you define the political elements in our society today? You talk about the conservatives as per the Journal report the other day about the conservatives are deserting the Republican Party and going into the independents. But what do the left, right, middle represent? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, I find it very interesting that conservatives don't believe they can be defined. At least that's the current intellectual approach they take. That they're neither a philosophy nor a nor any really kind of political theory or approach. They're more of an attitude. My old friend Senator Goldwater never had any trouble defining it. He always thought a conservative was somebody who drew from the wisdom of the past to apply it to the present and the future, which I always thought was a pretty good definition. It didn't mean you were looking backward all the time. You were trying to figure out how to use the past to deal with the present. The left-right spectrum today is so confused because of all the activism and noise on the fringes, and people think that's the real world, and it really is not. I think the polls I sift through, and the commentary that, particularly, I read a lot of academic stuff just out of curiosity. It looks to me like we're still basically a centrist nation, and that there is not a widespread between most people on most beliefs.
Where do the centrists stand, would you say, on Iraq right now?
They don't like it. When American businessmen say it's bad for the business, it's bad, it shows incompetency in government, we shouldn't have gotten in there in the first place, we were misled, I think there's a pretty strong national consensus that this is a war that is a disaster, and one way or the other, somebody's got to get us out of it.
How about immigration?
Tough issue. I was down in Southern California over the weekend in a town, Ensenada, where the town is just literally split on the issue. The business community think that they need the immigrants. The others think they're taking jobs. They can't get hard data that tells them one thing or another. That's sort of a microcosm of what's happening nationally. There are some people who believe that we should have open borders, but with people have to comply with the law to get their citizenship. There are others who would fence us in. It's not an easy issue, and it's very interesting to see how it's dividing the Republican Party this time
and the Democrats.
I mean, to a degree, yes.
Yeah.
Not as much, but to a degree. And Bush is certainly at odds with his party on this issue. He tends to be more what I think with the business community understands they need these people because they're doing the jobs Americans aren't willing to do.
Indeed. How about health care, universal single-payer health care?
Yeah, it's easy to march through all of the issues. I'm not an issue person anymore. I'm a process person. I think if you have a good process, you get good policy. If you have a bad process, you get bad policy. And that's been the drum I've been beating. Yes, I do follow what the difference between the Hillary and Obama and John McCain and their health care plans. But I find that most people don't get it when you get to talk. They glaze over when you start getting really deep into policy issues. What they do get is they do know when they're getting screwed. And they understand that their system is supposed to really work in the public interest, and they know when it's not. And that's the reason I'm pounding this process drum. That's what the Broken Government book is all about, because I think they are absolutely have had it with the system. And the fact, for example, the Democrats literally refuse to address process issues. The fact that they were being screwed by the Republicans in the Congress. The fact that Kerry would not raise the fact that Bush was the most secret presidency we'd ever had when he ran in 2004. The fact that he wouldn't even fight the nasty Swift voters who he could have taken to court and won a handsome judgment for that way they treated him.
That was mind-boggling, wasn't it?
There's been a total breakdown by the Democrats on process.
Indeed.
They're letting the conservative authoritarian core, the Republican Party, manipulate the system in a way that is dangerous. And that's my hot button these days.
John Dean, author of Broken Government, I want to thank you very much for being with us on America Back on Track today. I hope you'll come back, maybe drop by in Monterey and do it live here.
I would enjoy that. Enjoy chatting.
Thank you. I also want to tell you there are a whole bunch of folks out there who have a great deal of respect for you. Joe Burgess, who has the Green Dog Democrats Newswire, wrote a whole big piece about you, including your three fine law pieces, and you've got a lot
That's
of supporters
great.
Out there.
Thank you. That's nice to hear.
Thank you very much again, John.
Bye-bye.
Indeed. And we'll have a little music, and then we'll be back with more right after these messages.
won't be long before every business and most individuals will have their own website. Whether they are looking for new clients or posting information of use to their colleagues, the website makes printing brochures and price sheets, press releases, and community notices virtually obsolete. With your own website, you can provide the latest information as it becomes available on new products and services, special offers, and company news. You no longer have to stare at errors or out-of-date information that was printed up in bulk. For organizations, you can bring your message to the public, just as you are knitting tighter relations with your supporters and staff. The people who can make all of that possible are at Byte Technology. Find out more. Byte Technology. See the difference at byte-technology.com or call 831-656-9178. Byte Technology, 656-9178.
We'll be back, America Back on Track. And joining us now by telephone is Carlin Sloan. She has her own consulting company, and she's with Lindsay Pollack, written a book called Smarter, Faster, Better Strategies for Effective, Enduring, and Fulfilled Leadership. Carlin, welcome to America Back on Track.
Thanks so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, I was looking at your book and on your website, and it will attract, obviously, people who are interested in leadership and coaching and executive guidance and that sort of thing. But when you look a little deeper, there's considerable substance that travels into other areas that particularly are intriguing to me. You talk about reflection, which is so vital, it seems to me, today especially.
Yeah, which we don't take enough time for. So I think I agree it's one of the key concepts behind some of this work.
Tell me how you got into this.
Well, I started doing leadership development when I was very young, and I was in graduate school, paying for grad school, and I was at a consulting company that did wonderful work with leaders in Silicon Valley, and that's really how I started, and I loved it, and I have never left.
What was it that intrigued you so much?
Well, I'm really interested in peak performance, and so how do people really do what they wanted to do and do it in a sense of living their values? So I was really fascinated with leaders who are really inspiring and motivating because they're mainly people who have decided to live their passion or their values in some way.
Did you ever run into Charlie Garfield?
I did not.
Charles Garfield was one of the early pioneers in peak performance, using that term in the 80s. He himself had helped design the lunar module that first landed on the moon. He started the Shanti Project. And he talked about, he was also a powerlifter, an Olympic class powerlifter.
Yeah.
It is about what you want to do and be that makes such a difference.
It does, and it also makes a huge difference that you believe that you can. And I think that's one of the things that they see in sports psychology is about, you know, visualizing your success and focusing on the possibility of it coming true. And I see that as a real through line with the great leaders that I meet.
Okay, I need some therapy for a moment. Here's my question. I have been on in California, Northern California, since mostly since the early 80s, and I've often been told about visualize what you want in 6 months, that sort of thing. And where I run into trouble is that I don't really know what I'm going to be doing or supposed to, in quotes, in
right.
6 months, 2 years, 5 years. I know the direction. I know it's communications. I know it's doing what I'm doing now. But I don't know what to visualize.
Well, you know, I think this is a really great thing. I think there are two things to talk about here. One is when you think about, you know, those ideas and putting out your intent for the future, there's a real difference between visualizing what you'd like to happen and magical thinking, that you will just will it by thinking about it. So that's one topic to talk about in there. And the other one is, you know, what if you don't really know? Well, you know what? You probably have a good idea that you want the volume turned up on what you're doing already, or you want a certain emotional state to happen in the future. So instead of visualizing some specific, it could be, you know what, I would really like to be happy in 2 years. And that's just as valuable for you to visualize as any other thing.
Well, I understand the concept of that, but according to the Constitution of the United States, I think, or is it the Declaration of Independence, we're only supposed to pursue happiness, not actually get it.
not actually live it.
Yeah. But it is, of course, it is process, and it's a sense of being fulfilled. I had a friend who was an Aikido instructor who got derailed in a way. She discovered windsurfing on San Francisco Bay and literally got addicted to it. I mean, she was blowing off meetings and things like that. But she said that when she was out there and she had she was paying attention, when she was focused, she had her feet on the water and her hands in the wind, and when she did that and she did it right, she felt well used at the end of the day.
Beautiful.
Isn't that nice?
And may we all feel that way.
At the end of every day, perhaps.
You bet. Well, that's really one of the things that I love about seeing leaders in their element, is that I do think there's a moment when you achieve that mastery and that oneness with your surroundings, when you're really at your best. And I'm really interested in that. You know, that what you describe as the windsurfer is the same thing that you'll see in somebody who's really masterful at speaking, for example. You know, when you watch a great orator, like Bill Clinton, when you see Bill Clinton speaking, no matter if you agree with his politics or not, you look at him and he's having a wonderful time.
How do you interpret that?
Well, you know, what I see is he is really connected to his audience. He feels you can see that he has a sense of confidence with whatever he is talking about. The content is unimportant. He's just good at what he's doing in that moment.
Last night I delivered a seminar at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, where we have our studios on their campus, and it was a training for faculty and staff about interviewing. And I have a book out called The Quality Interview, Getting It Right on Both Sides of the Mic. And I brought up something. There was a woman who wrote the book Energy and Personal Power, Shirley Luthman, who said, "No writer worth his salt can deny having sat down and taken dictation." And in that same context, when one is speaking in public, obviously you want to know your stuff. You don't want to have to read it. You want it to come through you. And the way it comes through you is you are engaged with either the interviewer or directly or the audience.
Yep. And there's something in that where all your nervousness must disappear because you're focused on something other than yourself. And that's one of the things that I see in people who are very inspirational with organizations or as managers. I see people who forget their own ego and really focus on being of service to others or engaging others. It's a really different mindset.
Is it an instinctive thing, or can be people? I mean, obviously, you train people to get there.
You bet. I mean, I wouldn't be in the field I was in if I didn't believe people could learn this stuff. But I do think that there are people who have these things in them instinctively and are born with it, and there are other people who really need grooming and training and practice. But I think we all have greatness in us, or I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do.
And a lot of it, I would be willing to guess, is getting people out of their own way.
Yes. Indeed, that is true. And we're all in our own way in some way. And much of that comes from the systems that we work in. You know, we expect to be judged because, you know what, our culture is very judgmental. So, you know, when we think about all the people who are deathly afraid of what we've been talking about, public speaking, that's not because, you know, we have some just fantasy about how it will be bad. It's because we actually have a culture that's very judgmental and critical of public speakers.
You know, de Tocqueville, when he wrote Democracy in America, noted a couple of interesting traits which he thought intrinsic to Americans, and one of them was that instead of trying to raise ourselves, we try and pull our betters down.
And I do think that is I think that's the result of being a young culture, and it's some sort of maturity level that we haven't quite reached.
Oh God, are we approaching it? Are we nearing it? Do we have it in sight?
We can hope.
I mean, we're talking 160 years now, Carlin. Let's get it on, you know.
Oh, but think about, you know, how young that is in the scope of countries, the lives of countries or civilizations. You know, when you go to Asia and you see a building that's, you know, thousands and thousands of years old, and then you come here and you say, this building is old and it's from the 1800s.
Yeah, exactly that. Carlin, we're out of time. I hope you can come back, maybe come out and visit us in Monterey.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us on America Back on Track. And we will be back right after these messages. Stay tuned.
You know you can depend on QNN for honest news. Now we want you to know about an honest source of information on one of the country's most desirable vacation destinations, Carmel by the Sea on California's beautiful central coast. That source is the best address in Carmel, carmel.com. Just a few simple clicks and you're visiting a website that mirrors all that Carmel stands for: quality, character, tradition, beauty, the great outdoors by the sea, cultural heritage, and the best shopping, charming inns, superb dining, world-class art, music, and theater, a cornucopia of delights. So when you're planning your next getaway, go to the best address in Carmel, carmel.com, for tips on everything Carmel. Then put that information to good use by visiting Carmel by the Sea for an unforgettable getaway. Carmel.com.
It's not hard to find people in need. They're everywhere. And there's more than one kind of disaster that affects people's lives. There's AIDS and the millions of orphans the disease has left behind. There are teeming refugee camps, the result of war and persecution. Mary Knoll has been reaching out to the world's needy for nearly a century. Mary Knoll is there right now in 40 countries around the world. And with your help, Mary Knoll will be there tomorrow. Call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. And for more information, go to www.mygiftcounts.org. One world, one mission. Mary Knoll.
Before past the hour in time for seat notes. Our embargo against Cuba has always been absurd. It stems from the time-honored Cold War idiocy that says that every government that is socialist or communist must be our enemy. We couldn't distinguish among the